Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And first of all, I want to start by wishing you all a very happy and healthy 4th of July holiday. Lots of us are getting ready, or as you listen to this podcast, you may be in the midst of celebrating the 4th of July, relaxing, maybe doing something healthy on your behalf, doing some exercise, or maybe just chilling out, hanging out with friends, relatives, family, maybe putting something on the barbie, on the grill, and I hope that you have an enjoyable weekend. I've got a busy weekend in store. I'm going to spend the weekend at the beach and going to do, you know, some of the things that I like to do. Do some open water swimming, maybe some running, certainly some bicycling. I got a bunch of young kids coming to the house, and they will be willing foils for whatever activity I want to get them into. We've got kayaks, and we've got paddle boards. So we got a wide variety of activities on the menu. And plus, you know, it's a good time to just relax, maybe go to the local movie house and catch a corny movie. That's all part of our summer enjoyment. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to be pounding out a very vigorous workout schedule to be doing something healthy for ourselves. So whatever you're doing, I hope you enjoy it. And I wanted to start today's podcast with something a little different. From time to time, I would like to share with you information about the kinds of thought processes that go into being a holistic doctor, kind of a detective working with patients with various types of problems. And I think that this is a way of illustrating the method of natural medicine as a way of kind of bringing home some of the lessons and ideas. When we talk about supplements, we talk about lifestyle, we talk about diet, what you know, some of the actual impacts of these factors might be in treating real-life medical conditions. So here goes. The patient in question is a 30-something young man who came to see me recently complaining of anxiety. And by the way, this is probably one of the most prevalent complaints in doctors' offices these days. A lot of people suffering from anxiety. And, you know, I practice in New York City, so it's a high anxiety city. And I see lots, especially if I notice there's a tremendous, there's a real susceptibility of some of our younger 20-somethings and 30-somethings as they start their careers, as they start their lives. And a lot of stuff is not that well defined for them. So I would say that anxiety is the lot of many young people. It appears to, I mean, in some ways, you know, as you get older, you have more reasons to be anxious. You know, you're approaching, you know, your biological limits. You're concerned about health problems. You may see family members and friends dying. You know, let's face it, our futures are uncertain with the potential evaporation of Social Security and Medicare. There's lots to be worried about. But I have to say that the vast majority of my older patients, while they do suffer from anxiety, to a certain extent, that they are more stable and less anxious than some of the younger patients that I see. It's kind of paradoxical. So, you know, my first reaction in seeing a patient like this is, you know, I recognize the limits of natural medicine. There are some patients who just have overwhelming anxiety that is debilitating. It is, you know, considered by psychiatrists to be sort of the flip side of depression. A lot of people say, well, which is it? Is it depression? Or is it anxiety? And sometimes anxiety is a feature of profound depression. People feel everything is daunting. They have negative thoughts. They're constantly worried. They're virtually paralyzed by fear. And so it's necessary for me in seeing patients like this just to make sure that I'm being conscientious as a doctor, to make sure that I keep the patient safe, and also that I keep my treatments realistic because you know, we have to give patients full consideration of all modalities. I'm not just there to offer patients natural treatments. I'm there, you know, patients, you know, have a violent pneumonia. I might need to administer antibiotics. If patients have a severe flare of ulcerative colitis, I might have to put them on steroids or anti-inflammatory medication. You know, you get the idea that, you know, I wield both the natural therapies as well as the conventional therapies. So, you know, I did a certain degree of assessment to find out how profound this individual's anxiety was. And what I got for him, it was interesting. He was engaged in a very active sporting lifestyle. And, you know, some of the stuff that he does, you know, involves a certain amount of physical courage, stuff that I would find extremely adventuresome myself. And I said, wow, you know, when you're doing all that, these sporting exploits that you do, you don't seem to be anxious. And he said, no, I'm in the zone. I'm really plugged in. Unpredictably, from time to time at work, I get a real overwhelming sense of anxiety. I feel strange sensations in my chest pressure. Actually, I've been to the emergency room once or twice, and I thought I was dying. Well, you know, I said, that's typical. That's the feeling that you get when you have a panic attack. And, you know, I made sure to ascertain, even though he was young, that he actually didn't have, you know, some sort of cardiac problem, because just because a person is young and appears relatively slim and fit doesn't necessarily mean that they're not having a cardiac problem. Chest pressure is not something to be ignored. But he said, no, I got full consideration. They did a workup. They told me I was fine. And they sent me on my way and said, you might want to take some sort of anti-anxiety medication. They gave him some Xanax and said, you know, maybe consult a psychiatrist because you might need stronger medication. This is an idea that he found absolutely unacceptable. He really did not want to take medication, as a lot of people don't want to take medication. To some extent, when patients don't want to take medication, it can be constructive because, you know, we all want to avoid going on medication. Medication, you know, with its many side effects, treating anxiety with medication sometimes relieves the anxiety, but then it's replaced with other symptoms that are unacceptable. You may experience lethargy, drowsiness, spaciness. You may, and both men and women may experience sexual problems. And certainly that's an issue for a young man, you know, going on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication that might cause erectile dysfunction. That would certainly be a bummer. So, you know, we discussed this and I said, you know, are you amenable to talk therapy? And some patients, for one reason or another, they don't want to acknowledge that they've got a problem. They don't want to do talk therapy. But I'm a big advocate of talk therapy, as long as it's the right kind of talk therapy. I find that something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, works best for anxiety. This is a type of psychology. It's administered by both psychiatrists who have the prescription pad and non-prescribing psychologists, individuals with master's degrees or PhDs, who work with patients to deal with phobias and anxieties. And cognitive behavioral therapy, in a nutshell, is a way of behavior modification that teaches patients to experience the symptoms of anxiety and then place them in the right context and then not to catastrophize and to cope with the feelings. The feelings nonetheless exist and they're bothersome, but at least patients don't go down that rabbit hole of apprehension thinking that they're dying. They recognize that they have anxiety and they can, you know, sort of talk themselves out of extreme anxiety states. That's, in a nutshell, what that's about. And it's a nice fairly rapid intervention. You know, we tend to think of psychiatry in terms of the old Sopranos show where Tony Soprano season in and season out, you know, he kept going for psychotherapy. And, you know, it just went on and on and on. He talked about his family problems and his childhood. And, you know, it was like traditional psychiatry, which can be long, arduous, and expensive. And unfortunately, in the case of Tony Soprano, it didn't really make much difference in terms of his murderous tendencies. So not exactly a ringing endorsement for psychiatry. And of course, you know, if you remember the Soprano series, he indeed was suffering from a panic disorder. Ironic that the actual actor, James Gandolfini, suffered a major heart attack. So the chest pressure that he may have experienced at that time was unfortunately all too real. Anyway, so saw this patient, you know, did the basic intake, determined that the patient was very motivated to pursue a natural approach. Generally with patients, I say, look, you know, there's a chance that you may go on to require medication, but at least, you know, we have a plan B if the natural therapy doesn't work. Well, I'm very interested in trying the natural therapy. I agree. If it doesn't work, I'm open to medication, but I just really would rather avoid the medication. So we said, fine. So, you know, we did some tests, among the tests we did, you know, we did a whole battery of tests that we do on usual intake. And I said, you know, we'll report back to you on the tests. And I said, look, you know, a couple of things that I might suggest in the meantime. You could take some magnesium. Magnesium often helps to stabilize mood, and it really helps to regulate the heart. So I said, take some magnesium taurate. Magnesium taurate is particularly good for patients who have a tendency to have a racing heart. Magnesium regularizes the heart rate. It's good for atrial fibrillation, but also for just patients who have tachycardia and racing heart or symptoms of breathlessness. One of the things that he reported was he just felt like he couldn't catch a breath. And that actually is a syndrome that is related often to low levels of magnesium. There's actually a term for it in medicine, Ondine's curse. Ondine is a figure from Greek mythology who, in some way, as many characters in Greek mythology were wont to do, he dissed the gods. I think he lusted after one of Zeus's girlfriends, and he was punished by Zeus with the inability to breathe involuntarily. In other words, he would have to think every time that he would take a breath. If you can imagine what a burden that would be, is that you never can stop thinking about breathing. You know, many of us, you know, just think about it. You know, as you're sitting there listening to this narrative, you're breathing normally. You don't have to think about it. It's automatic. But Ondine had to remind himself to breathe, otherwise he would suffocate. Well, there are individuals who suffer from panic and anxiety where from time to time that is the case. They become very aware of their breathing. They feel they can't get a complete breath. And studies have shown that magnesium can be helpful for quelling that symptom. That's a little clinical pearl that I'll share with you. So I said try that. I also suggested a mild natural anxiety reliever that is non-sedating. It's called L-theanine. Theanine is derived from tea. And when the Brits have tea time, it's not like when we Americans guzzle Starbucks, although from what I see when I go over across the pond, I see there's more and more Starbucks and less tea. The culture is changing there. So they're, you know, they're 24/7 adrenaline addicted like we are. But traditionally, tea time was a time to relax, but also a time to refocus. And that's precisely what theanine, which is a constituent of tea, does. Coupled with a small amount of caffeine, it helps keep people alert, but it also helps with focus and relaxation. So it's a dual purpose. It's a non-sedating relaxing agent. So it's absolutely something you can take while driving or if you're flying a private plane. You don't have to worry that you're going to feel drowsy or have your reflexes slowed. And it's fine to take at work because you won't be stoned. So I said take a theanine capsule, you know, two, perhaps three times a day, best taken away from meals. And that might help you as a mild way of quelling anxiety. And you just take it on a regular basis. It's not going to do that much if you're having a full bore panic attack. But I said, that's there for you. And, you know, then I said, let's await the tests. And then I said, let's do a physical exam. I'm sure you're a pretty healthy specimen, but let's take a look at you anyway, because physical exam might give us clues as to what's going on. So in examining the patient, I noticed that his reflexes were very brisk. I tapped his kneecaps to look for the patellar reflex, and his knee thrust way out. And that is often a sign of inadequate levels of magnesium. What's significant about that is that magnesium helps to quell stress, but high levels of adrenaline and cortisol caused by stress deplete magnesium. So it's a vicious cycle. Many patients who are chronically stressed are low in magnesium. Magnesium can help to alleviate the stress, but they get into a vicious cycle where they become really depleted in magnesium. It's not just so much a matter of consuming adequate magnesium. It's also a matter of you just burn through your magnesium when you're subject to lots of stress. So I noticed that. I had him lay down and I listened to his heart. And I was listening for a particular factor, which is that patients who have a condition called mitral valve prolapse, or MVP, not to be confused with Major League Baseball, MVP is a condition where there's a slight heart murmur. And from the standpoint of conventional medicine, it's no big deal unless the heart valve is really misshapen and then the heart starts to fail and you have to have a valve replacement. It's just something that occurs with maybe 5 to 8% frequency in the general populace. And it's not something that too many doctors will comment on. And I said, you know, you have a little bit of a heart murmur. Were you ever told of mitral valve prolapse? He said, nobody's ever picked up on that before. And I said, well, that's interesting because mitral valve prolapse patients tend to be more nervous. They're more prone to panic attacks. They're sort of, sort of wild and crazy folks. Their nervous systems are much more sensitive. They are much more reactive to medications, to caffeine, to the effects of alcohol. Often if you treat them, you have to use a quarter dose of medications that normally would be well tolerated by other patients. They're highly sensitive individuals, by and large. So this was a clue to this young man's sensitivities. And I said, look, I think I hear a murmur, but I'm not sure. Let's send you for the confirmatory test, which is an echocardiogram. And he said, fine, I have good insurance. I'll go for my echocardiogram. So we sent him for that test. We performed some blood tests, and he came back a couple of weeks later. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, I'm doing a little better. He said, the magnesium really seems to have made a difference, and the theanine is helping. And, oh, by the way, and I asked, did you start the cognitive behavioral therapy? And he said, yes, I did. And he said, I found a person. The person is being very helpful. The person is helping me with breathing and relaxation exercises. And I said, great, things are moving in the right direction. I said, let's look at your tests. So what I discovered in testing him, and, there were a lot of things that were normal. He was, if you look at his blood tests, he was, for all the world, a normal, healthy, robust, young guy. As you might expect, regular blood tests. And indeed, that's what in the past regular blood tests had confirmed, that everything was fine. He'd been checked from stem to stern and everything checked out. But when I looked at his magnesium levels, they were low. So this is prior to the institution of magnesium therapy. And I said, great, you're starting to take magnesium, you're repleting your depleted magnesium, and that can make a difference in how you feel. I looked at his glucose tolerance test, and it was kind of surprising. This is a test that lasts for 5 hours. We give patients sugar, and we watch their blood sugar. We also measure their insulin. And generally, I didn't have this guy pegged for someone who might have blood sugar problems because he looked relatively thin, and he was pretty athletic. But it turned out that he had hypoglycemia, very low blood sugar. And I asked him how he felt during the test. He said, I started to feel a little rocky there. I said, your blood sugar went down to 50. That's sometimes the body sets off alarms when your blood sugar is that low. And that can actually trigger symptoms of anxiety, even if you have nothing to worry about. And I had asked him during his history, I said, do you have anything in particular that's stressful? Do you have a really problematic family situation or a dating situation or, an emotional breakup with a partner? Do you have inordinate job stress? And he actually said, look, the usual stuff, but nothing, no special stresses. Well, when you have low blood sugar, that actually creates an internal stress for your body that maybe apart from your external circumstances, everything could be going along swimmingly outside of you. But internally, when your blood sugar is very low, that sets off an alarm reaction in your body because your body wants to restore optimal levels of blood sugar so that your organs can survive. And in particular, the brain is very hungry for glucose. So you start to pour out stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, and this can cause your heart to race. It can cause your palms to sweat, make your extremities tingle or feel cold. And you're off to the races with a panic reaction from the low blood sugar. So I said, good. And then I looked at his insulin, and his insulin was actually on the high side. So here's a guy who, and I asked, you know, do you have a family history of diabetes? And he said, yes, you know, some of my older relatives do have type 2 diabetes. I said, well, no problem now, but you, you know, in 10 or 15 or 20 years, you could be on your way to type 2 diabetes because your insulin levels are high. Clearly, insulin can lower blood sugar, pushing it down, causing hypoglycemia. Excess consumption of insulin is associated with overconsumption of sweets and carbohydrates. So I said, okay, we're going to send you to our nutritionist, Layla, who's been a guest here on Health Talk, and she's an expert on the right kind of diet for hypoglycemia and insulin resistance. That's going to be a diet where you eat frequent, smaller meals, making sure that you have a balance between complex carbohydrates, but also healthy fats and plenty of protein to stabilize your blood sugar and to help you avert prediabetes. We measured his cortisol. That's a different test where we use a saliva test. We have patients spit into test tubes that they take home and then send out in a mailer 4 times daily on awakening and then mid-morning, mid-afternoon, and then evening. And his pattern was normal late in the day, but his early morning pattern, he showed a lot of cortisol production, which is typical of patients suffering from anxiety. So high levels of cortisol can be combated by, well, lifestyle changes. I mean, you know, relaxation, yoga, breathing exercises, but also just being conscious of how circumstances affect your stress levels. It's actually a nice piece of feedback that we can give to patients that, yeah, look, you know, your body's in overdrive. You're overproducing stress hormones. Maybe you need to rethink some of the things that are on your professional and personal menu. So that was those were some clues, clues as to the organic causes of his stress. I noticed from his history that he did not, you know, I asked, do you eat fish? That's an important question. Or do you take fish oil capsules? And he said, well, yeah, I have fish occasionally. I said, well, what kind of fish? He said, well, you know, mostly fried fish or occasionally white fish. I don't really like oily fish like salmon or tuna. And my initial thought was, you know, this is a guy who may be deficient in essential fatty acids. Lo and behold, a blood test revealed that he was low in EPA and DHA, which are important for optimizing brain function. It's been shown that low levels of EPA and DHA are associated with depression and certainly anxiety. And if you give fish oil pills to people who have rapid heart rate, it tends to stabilize the rapid heart rate, reduce the sympathetic tone. Sympathetic tone means too much adrenaline in your system, adrenaline toxicity or adrenaline overdrive that your body might have. Fish oil, very helpful in tuning down excess adrenaline in the body. So I said, we're going to add plentiful fish oil, you know, try to take 4, even 6 capsules a day. And vitamin D was a little low too. Vitamin D has a mood effect as well. So very interesting how test results and a physical exam can sometimes lead to a therapeutic approach for a person who's suffering from a condition that normally would be treated with, you know, immediately doctor would reach for the prescription pad, prescribe Xanax or Ativan or one of the antidepressant medications, because that's standard treatment. And by the way, it takes a lot less time. It's less labor intensive. And unfortunately, medicine is very prey to the quick reflex of offering a prescription instead of a detailed analysis. And the patient, at the end of that results visit, he was just ecstatic. He just felt great because already he was feeling better. He had a sense of self-mastery because here he was bringing this under control without dependency on medications. We'd actually pointed out specific causes. It was reassuring for him to learn that he had mitral valve prolapse, which made him more likely to experience these symptoms. By the way, I've gotten tremendous feedback on a book that I wrote about mitral valve prolapse, which you can get via the internet. It's Natural Therapies for Mitral Valve Prolapse by yours truly. And I have an article on our website at drhoffman.com about mitral valve prolapse. And I have to say that I've, you know, written tons of stuff in my day. I've gotten more great feedback on that article than on virtually anything else that I've written, because so many people suffering from mitral valve prolapse symptoms, weird, mysterious symptoms of breathlessness and anxiety and, you know, perplexing symptoms, have read this article and they understand that, okay, look, I'm not going crazy. I have a physiologic variation that makes me more prone to these types of reactions. And I think understanding is one of the initial steps towards self-healing. And so gaining a little more insight helps to empower a patient towards a wellness. And so here's a guy who's well-launched on a natural program of therapy for anxiety. And it doesn't always work out perfectly, I'll admit. You know, there's some patients who, you know, may require medication for a short period of time because the anxiety is too profound or the circumstances are too overwhelming. But for the most part, we can, at the very least, minimize patients' dependency on medication and often avoid need for medication altogether. Speaking of anxiety, if you really want something to worry about, there's a new report from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that talks about the dangers of third-hand smoke. Now, it took us a long time to acknowledge the dangers of smoking, although I think people recognized that smoking was bad for you. You know, even when it was first introduced in, you know, it was actually something that was brought back by the first we called them discoverers of the New World, and it became an overnight sensation throughout Europe, and then it spread to Turkey and the Middle East, and pretty soon everybody was smoking up a storm. I mean, the stuff is so addictive that it became an overnight sensation. And of course, then there were the people who were doing the chewing tobacco and the various forms of snuff. And so smoking was early on recognized to be something that was pretty addictive and also pretty bad for you. I mean, I see some of these old movies from the 1930s, and they talk about, guys are coughing, and they say, hey, maybe you should cut down on smoking. They knew it wasn't so great for you. They didn't realize how deadly it was. And, of course, the tobacco industry didn't acknowledge that it could kill you until widely publicized studies in the 1950s and the 1960s made it evident that smoking was highly dangerous and that it was directly associated with lung cancer risk and heart disease risk and the risk of many other problems. So that much we know. Then There was a certain amount of resistance to the idea that secondhand smoke was bad for you. I don't know how old some of you are, but I remember being on plane flights, and the fiction was that you could sit in the smoking section or the non-smoking section of a plane, and just because there was a little curtain interposed between the sections, that you were exempt from the risk of the smoke. I remember taking, you know, when I was much younger, a German plane, a Lufthansa plane, and there was a smoking section and a non-smoking section. Of course, that was totally absurd because the air is recirculated throughout the cabin, and it was nuts. So it took a long time, and the industry did the same thing. They said, look, the studies on secondhand smoking, they're junk science. There's no way that, come on, we acknowledge that, you know, if you smoke, that's a problem. But secondhand smoke, come on. There's no way, no how does that create a problem for the non-smoking spectators. Well, now, of course, we recognize that there are good health reasons for laws such as those that prohibit smoking in bars and restaurants. Plus, you know, it makes a much more pleasant, more aesthetic atmosphere for non-smokers. But in addition, you know, it's not just about that. There are real health risks to imbibing secondhand cigarette smoke. So now, researchers at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory have found that third-hand smoke may be even more dangerous than second-hand smoke. What's up with that? What is third-hand smoke? Well, it's the nicotine residue that settles from exhaled cigarette smoke and clings to literally any surface, from clothing and carpets to cars and people. Now, you know, that's one of the reasons why people ask for non-smoking hotel rooms, because, you know, even if you don't intend to smoke, I mean, what's the point? You're not going to smoke. What do you care? You're in a hotel room where somebody has smoked before. Big deal. Get over it, right? Well, the smell of smoke for many people is so nauseating and disgusting that now there are big fines if you smoke in a hotel room. You know, you're not going to burn the place down. But even if, you know, you surreptitiously smoke a cigarette and then flush it down the toilet, after you leave, they may come in and say, oh, my God, somebody's been smoking in here. We'll send this guy a big bill. And, you'll see that actually sometimes in the contract or the fine print when you get a hotel room, is that they will bill you for the abatement of the smoke. Whatever they do something else like a special clean down, and they use ozone generators to kill the smoke odor. Used car salesmen are very aware of this. There's special treatments for cars of smokers because they don't want that smoke residue smell to linger. But it's more than just an aesthetic problem. It is the effect may be due to the fact that third-hand smoke is just as mutagenic, that's a word that means cancer-causing, as other kinds of smoke. And they say that it actually may even be more dangerous in a sense, because third-hand smoke contains less chemicals or tobacco byproducts than secondhand smoke, right? I mean, there's fewer of these myriad chemicals in it, but the few chemicals that third-hand smoke contains have a special affinity to react with common household air pollutants like ozone and nitrous oxide, and the resulting transformed smoke residues seem to be particularly hazardous to our cells. And they're also very tiny. They're able to enter a human body with minimal difficulty. They can be ingested or inhaled, but they can literally pass through human tissue, including your skin. So they can actually, you know, if you touch surfaces where smoke has been deposited, the residues can be quite carcinogenic, and they can pass through your tissue. And, you know, it's very resistant. It's very hard to get rid of. You can try to vacuum or wash and spray air freshener, but it's very stubborn. And scientists have found that this nicotine residue can last for at least 2 months after the last smoke, although it may last even longer, according to some studies. The Berkeley study's recommendation is the best way to get rid of it is just to replace whatever might have been contaminated, whether it's a carpet or the bed sheets. So the one saving grace here is that the danger is cumulative. So if you have a minimal exposure, I mean, look, people are worrywarts. And when I say this, you know, people are going to say, oh, my God, I was exposed to this stuff. It's, you know, I'm doomed. It seems that the intensity of the third-hand smoke you're exposed to is less important than how often you're exposed to it. It has a cumulative effect. And so, you know, look, I mean, what this calls for is more responsibility by smokers and, you know, unfortunately, more regulation of smoking, because, you know, it's one thing to regulate other forms of lifestyle choices. If you want to do yourself in, fine. But if you're doing yourself in entails doing other people in, then you're impinging on their rights to stay healthy. So if you're a smoker, fine. You know, you want to do yourself in. You know, it's like it's a horrible habit. You're killing yourself. It's a free country. Do your thing. But it's bad for your family. And if you're going to be a smoker, please take it outside or take it, you know, one of the few public spaces where they're now still allowing smoking. It's getting more and more difficult for smokers, especially here in New York, where smoking is even banned in many public spaces. But that's all to the good, because us non-smokers, in my case, I'm a former smoker, we don't want to be around it, because if we choose to stay healthy, we don't want it imposed on us. Okay, this time of year, as we get ready to celebrate the 4th of July, we remember our founding fathers, including Benjamin Franklin, who was famous for saying, "Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise." There's a spate of studies that suggest that there are benefits to getting additional sleep, also that sleep timing may be critical for health. So this one from the University of Pennsylvania says that people who regularly go to bed late are more likely to gain weight because of the late night eating they indulge in. And I think that's just part of the story. What they did in this experiment is they took 225 healthy non-obese individuals aged between 22 and 50. They divided them into two groups. All participants spent 18 consecutive days in the laboratory. And the first group was restricted to only 4 hours of sleep per night from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m., which is it's kind of like what your college kids coming home from school this summer will be experiencing, because that's a typical sleep pattern for a kid, although it's hard to get them up at 8 a.m. But that's the 4 a.m. part, that's dead on for people with undisciplined sleep habits. The second group slept for 10 hours from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. All participants were served meals at scheduled times. However, food was always available to anyone who wanted to eat at times apart from mealtime. So they had a nice little smorgasbord sitting around there, and you could get in there and have a little snacky poo. For recreational purposes, they were allowed to watch TV, play video games, read, and perform sedentary activities. They couldn't exercise. They could sort of walk around in the lab, but basically, this experiment recreates what it's like for your kids coming home from college. Researchers found that participants who received 4 hours of sleep for five consecutive days, no brainer here, they gained more weight than participants who received 10 hours of sleep daily. They also observed, again, this don't have to be a rocket scientist, that sleep-restricted patients consumed more calories because of extra meals and snacks they consumed owing to the additional hours they were awake. So, you know, the conclusion is, I think, a little misleading, because what you're saying is, okay, I mean, obviously, you are awake more, and I think you may have noticed this. You know, let's say, you know, you're on a trip and you get stuck in an airport and, you know, the flight's delayed and you got to, you know, stay up. You know, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to go for a snack at a time where if you were home, you would just be turning in, going to bed, and prudently avoiding eating late. But so what they're saying here is if you have more time awake, you're going to eat more. And there's no question, because, you know, just in terms of, you know, if you're asleep, it's hard to eat unless you're a sleepwalker. But there's more to it than that, is if you're in sleep deprivation, what happens is you actually will have a problem with insulin. Insulin overproduction, cortisol overproduction due to stress will cause you to have an elevation in your fat storing potential, an increase in appetite. And this is part and parcel of the syndrome that happens to shift workers. Okay? So, I mean, other studies have shown that simply the timing of eating, I mean, if you eat early, it's better than if you eat late. eating late tends to sock on the pounds. Merely staying, you know, they should do this experiment with just, you know, getting 8 hours of sleep, but make your sleep from 4 a.m. to noon, as opposed to, say, midnight to 8 or 11 to 7. I think you're going to see a difference in the way that your body handles the identical amount of calories. I think that's an experiment worth doing if it hasn't already been done. All right, here's another study that relates to this. Long-term night shifts linked to doubling of breast cancer risk. This is something we've already known. We just didn't know how severe the effect was. Working night shifts for 30 or more years doubles the risk of developing breast cancer. And it's not confined to just nurses, as previous research has indicated. This study was performed in occupational and environmental medicine. Now, what they did is they looked at a group of women in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Kingston, Ontario. And they weren't just nurses, because the thought was, okay, you know, fine, they found that this night shift nurses, they gain weight, but, you know, maybe it's just because of the junk food in the hospital and, you know, there's not a good, you know, eating opportunities, or there's something particular about nurses. They just found that no matter what kind of work you did, if you were a woman and you had a night shift, you were more likely to get breast cancer, double the risk. And so what they're saying is that this may be due to melatonin, because lack of sunlight will cause lack of darkness, sort of the opposite of vitamin D. Melatonin gets produced in the dark. If you don't have natural darkness, if you're under fluorescent lights all the time and you're not seeing a natural darkness, that you won't be producing adequate melatonin. Melatonin is protective against cancer, but it may also be related to other factors. The fact that there's more chaotic eating, that individuals may be heavier, they may consume more carbs. Working at night, you might not get adequate vitamin D. Just the upset body rhythms, excess cortisol and stress hormones may increase the risk of cancer. So it's not clearly just about melatonin. You know, if you were a night shift worker, it might behoove you to take additional melatonin, especially if you're a woman, because that might help to mitigate the increased risk that you have. Might not completely eliminate it. But let me add one more item to this. There's actually a great new book. It's about to come out, entitled The End of Night: Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. And so, you know, we talk about the paleo diet, you know, eating natural foods, but actually part of the paleo lifestyle, part of the lifestyle of most individuals until the advent of electricity in the late 19th century, was darkness. You know, the lights went out, and yeah, you'd had candlelight, but there wasn't a lot of bright lights. There wasn't 24/7 opportunities to stay awake. And this is a book by Paul Bogard. It's a brand new. It's going to come out soon. And it's a book that talks about the fact that there are very few places on Earth where you can actually see the stars as our ancestors did. There's light pollution virtually everywhere. And the author has talked to researchers who see a link between lighting and cancer. And we have clearly, this is an element in health. You know, so if we want to emulate the paleo lifestyle, it's not just about eating paleo foods and exercising. It's also about having natural rhythms of sleep that may mirror the natural rhythms of light and darkness, which are elusive, to say the least, in our modern age. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us for the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, and have yourself a great 4th of July weekend. Remember, our podcasts are available via iTunes and now Stitcher, and you can go to drhoffman.com and download them and subscribe to them. And you can also get podcasts of our weekend edition of Health Talk, which is available at wor710.com. Also, if you want to subscribe to our great newsletter, our newsletter is available if you email us to radioprogram@aol.com. And here's something new that we're starting. If you have a question, you have a medical issue or problem that you want us to talk about on the air, we're not going to call you and give you personal care. You have to come in as a patient if you want individual care. But if you want to give us a theme for a podcast discussion, just send us your question about a medical issue or a medical problem. And, you know, don't make it a big, long diatribe. You know, just try to summarize it in a paragraph. And we'll try and answer your question here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast that'll provide us with grist for the mill for discussion. Radio program at AOL.com gets you a subscription to the newsletter. It'll also get you an entree to have your medical issue or concern aired on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, anonymously, of course. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Ronald Hoffman here. Have yourselves a great holiday weekend.